Greetings and welcome to ID the Future. I'm Casey Luskin, broadcasting with Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture in Seattle, Washington. Today we have on the show with us again Nancy Piercy, who is a fellow of Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture, as well as a professor and scholar in residence at Houston Baptist University. She's the author of the 2005 ECPA Gold Medallion winner, Total Truth, Liberating Christianity from Its Cultural Captivity, as well as various other books. Today, Nancy is on the line with us to talk about some excerpts from her new book, Finding Truth, Five Principles for Unmasking Atheism, Secularism, and Other God Substitutes. So thank you so much for coming back on the show with us.
Thank you, Casey. Appreciate your having me.
Oh, well, it's very fun to talk about these sort of larger philosophical implications of the debate over evolution, which, frankly, we don't always get to talk about. In your book, you talk about how there are spiritualized versions of evolution. Even though we often associate evolutionary thinking with materialistic ideology, some folks have tried to create these spiritualized versions of evolution, and the famous philosopher Hegel promoted such a view. So what is Hegel's evolutionary deity, as you call it in your book?
Right. I think that sometimes we get caught up in just critiquing and talking about naturalistic, materialistic forms of evolution, but we fail to see that an awful lot of our culture does accept a more spiritualized view, and in fact, the spiritualized view of evolution is a source of postmodernism. If your kids and people you know are studying the arts or English or the social sciences, they're more immersed in a postmodern view. And I think it's really important for us to recognize the connection of evolution to those views as well, and not just the sort of reductionist materialist views. So it starts with Hegel. And Hegel proposed a kind of pantheistic deity that he called the absolute spirit or the universal mind, a kind of soul of the world that was said to evolve along with the world. And this was 100 years before Darwin, of course. In fact, Nietzsche once said that without Hegel, there would not have been a Darwin. And the difference is that Hegel applied the concept of evolution not to biology, that was where Darwin came in, but to the world of ideas. So his claim was that ideas, law, morality, religion, art, politics, all result from what he called the gradual actualization of the universal mind over the course of history. So in other words, the universal mind is evolving through history and producing different cultures with all of their different ideas. So what is this called? This is sometimes called historicism. That's the doctrine that all of our ideas are products of historical forces. So what's true at one stage of history will give way to a higher truth at the next stage. Of course, there's a logical flaw here to start with. It's self-refuting. Historicism is self-refuting. The claim that every idea is just a partial and relative truth has to be applied to itself. Like every other evolving idea, historicism is relative to its own moment in history, so it's not true in any trans-historical sense.
It's kind of like those who say as an absolute truth that there are no absolute truths, that old fallacy you'll hear from the man on the street when they're talking about their own worldview. It seems like historicism has that same problem.
Right. There's different forms, different sources of relativism. And historicism is a source of relativism. And my favorite quote, actually, is the philosopher John Passmore, who says, "You cannot maintain as a timeless philosophical truth that there are no timeless philosophical truths." By the way, how did Hegel get around this? Well, just like anyone else whose theory is deconstructing, he made a tacit exemption for himself. He wrote his theories as though somehow he was alone, mysteriously able to rise above that evolutionary process, as though he were capable of a timeless, objective view of the whole historical progress. So there you go. Every non-Christian worldview comes up with some form of self-contradiction. Now the question is, okay, how do we get from Hegel to postmodernism? How do we get from a kind of spiritualized evolution to the postmodernism that's so common on our campuses today and working its way into the law and policy as well? Here's the connection. For Hegel, then, the real actor in history is not the individual. It's that absolute mind or spirit, which is expressing itself through the community's laws, you know, morality, religion, social relationships, and so on. And so what that means is individuals don't really even have original ideas of their own. their thoughts are expressions of that absolute mind evolving through history. Or as he put it, individuals are just unconscious tools of this sort of collective mind. Now, Hegel's pantheism over time gets secularized. His absolute spirit becomes a metaphor for the spirit of the age. But what remained was the notion that individuals are unconscious tools of the zeitgeist, the spirit of the age, that they're not producers of culture so much as products of culture, that they're shaped by the communities that they belong to. Communities based on race, class, and gender.
That's another question I wanted to ask you, Nancy. I mean, how have Hegel's ideas led to a society that's divided based upon race, class, and gender? And I feel like in the year 2015, we thought that we were getting over divisions, but many of the divisions that maybe were sort of starting to heal have been exacerbated. So I feel like all this stuff is coming back, and it's interesting for us to understand the roots of these really unfortunate and tragic divisions that are afflicting society right now. How did Hegel's ideas play into that?
Exactly. Because Hegel taught that individuals are really just expressions of a more collective mind, that became secularized as, well, individuals are just mouthpieces for the communities that they're part of, their racial community, their race, class, gender, sexual identity, and so on. And so it's a very reductionistic view. It's a very dehumanizing because it essentially reduces individuals to puppets of social forces. The implication is that people hold certain ideas not because they have good reasons, but because they're black or they're white. They're a man, they're a woman, they're Asian, they're Hispanic, they're gay or straight. It's incredibly dehumanizing because it implies that individuals are powerless to rise above the communities that they belong to. It's a kind of reductionism that dissolves the individual into the group identity. And so postmodernism may be leagues away from the materialism that's rampant in the science department, but it's just as dehumanizing. Because if materialism reduces humans to products of physical forces, postmodernism reduces them to products of social forces.
Now, Nancy, you also talk about diversity and how diversity sounds great in theory. I mean, my wife and I value diversity greatly. We go to an inner city church. We have friends of lots of different races and backgrounds, and it's a hugely wonderful thing. But how do things go wrong as far as diversity goes?
Right. Now, on the positive side, it's always good to ask where these ideas came from. And many of the founders of postmodernism were Europeans. And they had witnessed firsthand history's bloodiest century, right? The 20th century was the bloodiest ever, and much of the carnage was driven by totalitarian political systems, by Nazism, communism. And so the early postmodernists decided, well, if totalitarianism results from what they called totalizing meta-narratives, in other words, they said, It's the ideology that drives us. It's any attempt to explain all of reality or explain all of history, where civilizations came from and where they're going. The technical definition for meta-narrative is a philosophy of history. And so they decided, the postmodernists decided, the way to prevent concentrations of power is to maintain a variety of mini-narratives instead of meta-narratives that explain the whole scope of history and where it came from, where it's going. What we do is we maintain lots of small narratives. Every little group, every little community has their own language games. And by celebrating that kind of difference and diversity, postmodernists hope to avoid the coercion that's inherent when a society is organized around a single absolutized kind of concept. Well, the trouble is, of course, that only select groups tend to be singled out for diversity. And only the sort of politically correct groups like race, class, gender, ethnic group, sexual identity. And there's very little push for true intellectual diversity or political diversity or theological diversity, at least when those views run counter to postmodernism. And in addition, the analysis is almost always borrowed from Marxism. The group is said to be victimized, and the path to liberation is to overcome your false consciousness, revolt against the oppressors, usually through political activism. So that is why political activism has taken over the typical college campus, for example. So the upshot is postmodernism started with, I think, a noble goal of trying to unmask the imperialism of many of the Enlightenment worldviews, the modernist worldviews, but it has become imperialist itself because the postmodernists claim that they alone have the ability to unmask everyone else's underlying interests and false consciousness and to deconstruct them and to debunk them. And as a result, it ends up silencing anyone else. It says, I see through what you're really saying. I can see your hidden personal interests that are really driving you when you make this statement. And therefore, they use the postmodern, the deconstructive theories and techniques in order to silence any opposition. I would like to point out, once again, we see how secular views are self-refuting. Because if the postmodernist says, human rationality is swamped by non-rational social forces like race, class, and gender. But then what about their own theory? If they're going to be consistent, they have to apply their view of knowledge to themselves. They have to apply their epistemology to themselves. So are they just mouthpieces for their race, class, and gender? See, once again, they're self-refuting. They undercut themselves. Their view commits suicide.
I think that's a common theme that's coming through both this podcast and the previous one we did, that basically when you base your worldview, is when it's founded upon an evolutionary viewpoint where there's not sort of objective truth, where you're sort of just extrapolating from whatever helps you survive, and there's no objective moral truth, you end up with these internal contradictions.
The key is your view of the human person. Evolution always has a reductionistic view of the human person. Either in materialist evolution, the human person is reduced to natural forces, the blind forces of nature. In the Hegelian-inspired spiritual evolution, the human being is reduced to social forces. Either way, you're reducing people to less than people made in God's image who reflect the divine mind. And so once you accept a reductionist view of the human person, you will also accept a reductionist view of human reason, the mind, rationality, reason. And yet, how do proponents make their own case? They have to use reason. Otherwise, they commit suicide. So this is the bind that they're caught in. As soon as you say that human reason is really driven by the forces of natural selection, or human beings are really driven by social forces of race, class, and gender, you've got a problem, because then that theory can be turned back on yourself and you deconstruct. Or you try to exempt yourself from your own view, act as though somehow you're magically able to float above the forces that discredit everyone else. But then, of course, that's a logical contradiction in your theory, too, because you're saying there's one thing that your theory doesn't cover, namely yourself. So either way, there's a logical contradiction whenever you have a reductionist view of the human person.
Well, this is really helpful. Nancy Piercy, thank you so much for coming on the show with us to discuss your new book, Finding Truth, Five Principles for Unmasking Atheism, Secularism, and Other God Substitutes. I'm Casey Luskin with ID the Future. Thanks for listening.
Hi, it's Hugh Hewitt. Are the only objections to Darwin's theory based on religion? Darwin's Doubt by Stephen Meyer will explode your preconceptions. New York Times bestseller, the book has been praised by Harvard geneticists, debated by America's most prestigious science journal, and now it's been released in paperback with a new chapter. When Stephen Meyer was on my show, all the audience wanted to, and they went out and got Darwin's Doubt. Get Darwin's Doubt at darwinsdoubt.com. Don't waste another minute. Find out what the real debate is about. Learn the debate at darwinsdoubt.com.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute 2015. For more information, visit www.intelligentdesign.org or www.idthefuture.com.